From underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo, anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. He tried the nice guy who was cooperating with the president.
And we are back here at the People's Power Hour, and we are speaking tonight with Asia Russell.
Asia Russell is Director of International Policy for HealthGap Global Access Project, a U.S. advocacy organization confronting the obstacles that stand in the way of universal access to HIV treatment in developing countries. As a member of ACT UP Philadelphia, Asia Russell has been an AIDS activist all of her adult life, coordinating local and national campaigns on issues including AIDS drug pricing, HIV research in women, and treatment access for HIV-positive prisoners before focusing on global AIDS treatment access issues.
Asia, welcome to the People's Power Hour.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Could you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in these issues?
Well, when I was in high school, I realized that the movement of efforts around AIDS activism united social justice issues that meant the most to me as a young person. So in order to be an effective AIDS activist in the United States, it meant confronting issues around racism, around poverty, around heterosexism and homophobia, and around the marginalization of women. Since the AIDS crisis is probably the most important public health crisis and human rights crisis facing my generation, it seemed like the most important way for me to get involved and engaged with meaningful activism that was based on results and on campaigns that could make a concrete impact on friends and colleagues and loved ones and comrades of mine who were becoming sick and were dying.
And tell us a bit about HealthGap. What is it?
Well, in 1999, HIV was being transformed in rich countries from a death sentence to something approaching a chronic, manageable illness, albeit one that is treated through lifetime chemotherapy, so it's far from a walk in the park. These medicines, their combination antiretroviral treatments, that although they're highly toxic, are also highly effective in fighting HIV, and suddenly death rates in Western Europe, in Japan, and in the U.S. and Canada were dropping like a rock. And AIDS activists looked around and realized that they had, after more than 12 years, come upon some fantastic progress. But then, as Americans, we did some further digging and realized, of course, that 95% of the world's tens of millions of people living with HIV actually aren't lucky enough to be living in rich countries. They live primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, also in Latin America and the Caribbean, and in South Asia and Southeast Asia, where access to medicines, access to treatment and care, and access to life-saving prevention tools are the exception and not the rule. So HealthGap was really a project that was born out of efforts by AIDS activists, by people living with HIV, fair trade activists, doctors, human rights experts, who were all sick and tired of a kind of a medical apartheid that was keeping life-saving tools out of the hands of people around the world who actually needed them the most.
And what is the greatest barrier to these people getting drugs in the third world?
There are actually many barriers, but what we found in the late 90s was a primary barrier was, two barriers. One, a fundamentally ignorant and racist orientation to public health. That is, an idea that antiretroviral treatment should be reserved for rich parts of the world that have more infrastructure and that by virtue of them being places of wealth, have received more resources and more investments, unlike sub-Saharan Africa, which has, because of decades of neglect, because of the legacy of colonialism, has been stripped of its natural resources, and so the fabric of public health systems have been weakened over many, many years, and access to fundamental resources kept out of the hands of impoverished people there. So turning around the views of policymakers, politicians, and even doctors and public health experts who asserted quite simply that antiretroviral treatment, life-saving treatment for HIV in poor countries would be impossible, would be a waste of money to implement, and wouldn't be cost-effective. That was a fundamental barrier that only activism could effectively transform. And through challenging those beliefs and those assertions, through mobilizing communities of people with HIV in the United States and working in solidarity with AIDS activist communities halfway around the world, we were able to challenge those beliefs and force the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration to at least claim to embrace antiretroviral treatment as a fundamental part of fighting the AIDS pandemic around the world. That didn't happen because they changed their minds overnight or because they didn't have access to information that suddenly they got access to. It happened because the political consequence of their decisions became more costly to them through activism and through education and community mobilization. So that was one barrier. Another very key barrier is price. All around the world, medicines, they're essential commodities. They're as important as access to clean water, access to education, access to housing. Unfortunately, although many of these pills cost pennies to make, they're actually charged at very high prices that bear nothing to the, they bear no relation to the marginal cost of the production of these products. So we encountered situations where Pfizer's antifungal drug called Diflucan, the generic name is fluconazole, in places like Kenya in East Africa, a very impoverished country in sub-Saharan Africa, this drug was priced as expensive as it was in the Netherlands, so at about $10 a pill, when in Thailand, generic pharmaceutical companies were literally making the same product for pennies. So we encountered price and the patent and other trade policies that often accompanied price as major barriers that we just felt were absolutely unconscionable. They didn't make any economic sense, and more importantly, they made no moral sense.
So can you tell us a bit about the relationship between these trade agreements and access to these life-saving drugs?
Sure. You would think in the world of globalization and integration of markets across the world, sort of fundamental rallying cry of the rich countries is that they want to do away with protectionist barriers to trade. But as so often happens with the language of globalization, you dig a bit deeper and you realize sometimes exactly the opposite is happening than what's actually being argued. And that's the case with trade policy and the policies of both the World Trade Organization and also policies that have been handed down since the implementation of the World Trade Organization in 1994 and 1995, these bilateral and regional trade agreements that the U.S. and other countries have entered into with different groupings of countries around the world. So to start with the example of the World Trade Organization, there is a whole requirement. The World Trade Organization is a body of about 145 countries, and in entering this organization, any country has to agree to this minimum standard of regulations that the organization sets out. And drug companies, led, in fact, by Pfizer, the biggest drug company in the world, fought over about 10 years as the World Trade Organization was being put into place to ensure that intellectual property rights would become part of the World Trade Organization. Intellectual property rights establish different levels of monopoly protection, so pure protectionism, as a way to protect innovations of different sorts of products that are brought to the market. So for many people, it's a complete anathema to what's talked about as being free trade, that is, the opposite of protectionism. But because drug companies and their allies, particularly the United States and Western Europe, and the negotiating bloc that's known as the Quad in the World Trade Organization, they were quite interested in the agenda of the pharmaceutical industry, so they fought very hard alongside Pfizer to ensure that the World Trade Organization would include a sweeping new agreement on intellectual property rights. And they got their way. It's a treaty called TRIPS, or the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. And the bottom line with this agreement is this. Most poor countries that were entering into the World Trade Organization didn't have patent protection for pharmaceuticals. In fact, they had deliberately set those kinds of monopoly protections aside, recognizing that investment of limited resources and building up other sorts of infrastructure for their people probably was a better and more sound economic investment than ensuring that drug companies could charge monopoly rents on essential products. The World Trade Organization took those sorts of heterogeneous considerations out of the hands of poor countries, so that suddenly Kenya would have to have the same intellectual property rights regime as, say, Japan does. So it contradicted centuries of understanding about what economic development made the most sense for countries at different levels of industrialization. But that didn't matter for the commercial interests that were fighting so hard in creating the World Trade Organization. So to sum up, this treaty required countries to implement 20-year patent protections on all products, whether they're essential, like drugs, or whether they're non-essential, like new inventions of sneakers or CDs or cars. It treated them all the same. And it didn't make an exception for the products that people need in order to stay alive, or technologies that people rely on to strengthen public health. So that's the relationship fundamentally between trade policy and access to medicines. It's protecting intellectual property rights over and above the interests of those of us who are focusing on public health and on broader and more equitable access to life-saving commodities.
Asia, you pointed out the duplicity or hypocrisy, perhaps, in the rhetoric used by the World Trade Organization, for instance, you know, claiming free trade but actually working to promote protectionism that benefits Western corporations. I was curious if you also saw any similar duplicity, perhaps, in the way that the pharmaceutical corporations portray what they're doing for AIDS and HIV patients in the developing world.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. When activists first began singling out Pfizer, for example, for protest in 1999 and in 2000, Pfizer responded with a kind of a charm offensive where they developed a philanthropic organization that was intent on donating one drug in particular, the drug I mentioned earlier called fluconazole or Difucan, in poor countries. Primarily, this occurred because they were concerned about the negative publicity that they were being subjected to through protests in South Africa, protests in New York, and in other cities in the United States. And challenges at different international meetings, like the International AIDS Conference that happens every 2 years. In addition, at the time that Pfizer started its philanthropic intervention, fluconazole's patent was about to die in the United States. So they also recognized quite cunningly that if they could invest in an incremental innovation in the antifungal and get additional periods of exclusivity or additional patents on a kind of a me-too antifungal, then it wouldn't quite matter if they made a kind of a paltry investment in donation programs. I think the other key lesson from the extraordinarily unsatisfactory philanthropic responses of drug companies like Pfizer is that the thing that they're most afraid of is competition, that is entering the market and competing side by side by the Thai drug companies and the Brazilian and the South African and the Indian drug companies who make quality generics at a fraction of the cost. And the economics of donation programs mean that they can avoid a bona fide competitive market-based framework, and they can simply put their products on the market by interacting directly with different healthcare providers, different hospitals, so they can, in their minds, get kind of the best of all worlds by writing off a philanthropic donation on their taxes every year, and by keeping a corner on the market, particularly the private sector in these poor countries that still, in many cases, have a middle class, and by seeming to be responding in the most comprehensive way by. At least when you brush the surface, they claim to just be giving away the drug for free and thereby solving the problem. I think one other indicative anecdote is the case of Latin America and the Caribbean. Pfizer's drug, fluconazole, is actually used by people with HIV in order to prevent and to cure a deadly fungal infection of the brain called cryptococcal meningitis. It's incredibly painful. It's entirely avoidable, and it's just a devastating complication of this immune compromised state that people with HIV find themselves in. And in some Latin American countries where Pfizer's market and investment is quite small, except among the minority of rich elite, Pfizer was claiming to be investing a lot of time and effort in these drug donation programs, but in fact, the person in charge of the drug donation program was based in South Africa, and she was doing nothing to inform healthcare providers and people with HIV that this free drug existed. So no one was using it, and people were dying and are continuing to die unnecessarily of cryptococcal meningitis because Pfizer's words and Pfizer's deeds didn't and don't match up.
That's very interesting the way you explain it. It seems like they're calling it charity, and what happens is they are essentially getting a tax break to run a PR campaign.
Absolutely. And as your listeners probably know, the pharmaceutical industry, in addition to being the most profitable, is the most powerful in terms of its lobbying force in the U.S. Congress. It was the second largest contributor to the 2000 presidential election. And as a consequence, directly, it receives some of the most intense tax breaks through its lobbying to Congress. There's also a very pronounced revolving door effect. That is, Billy Talzin from Louisiana recently left U.S. Congress after co-sponsoring many different bills that gave big handouts to the drug industry, and now he's the head of the pharmaceutical lobbying arm of the industry, which is called PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers of America. So we see that sort of revolving door happening all the time into the Bush administration and out of the Bush administration as well.
Can you tell us more specifically about the agreements for pharmaceutical corporations that were sort of hidden in the CAFTA agreement that recently passed through Congress?
Sure. One thing that advocacy was able to create was a pretty dramatic transformation of the way the international community looks at trade agreements and access to medicines. This happened in 2001, right after the anthrax scare in the United States. There was a meeting of the World Trade Organization. They have these ministerial meetings every year. There's another one that's going to happen in December in Hong Kong. The last one that happened was in Cancun last year. And in 2001, the meeting was in Qatar, in an emirate in the Middle East. And the Africa group of WTO countries had gotten together, and NGOs had gotten together, different advocacy organizations, and demanded that the World Trade Organization issue a declaration that poor countries, despite their obligations to protect these drug company patent rights, that poor countries should put public health first and even break pharmaceutical company patents if they needed to prioritize getting access to affordable treatments for their people, not just for HIV, but HIV was the most indicative and most sort of rich case study, seen as 8,500 people are dying every single day of HIV. So this declaration was passed over the objections of the U.S. Trade Representative and of the White House. The White House even intervened and called the head of the WTO, who at the time was Mike Moore. So it was a pretty tremendous example of what raw lobbying power from the people could produce. Unfortunately, right after that bit of progress in a multilateral forum, as pro-business as it is, like the World Trade Organization, the Bush administration revved up its efforts to win big extractions through bilateral trade agreements. These trade agreements that are even less transparent than anything that happens at the World Trade Organization, because it's secret closed-door negotiations between countries that more often than not have terrifically asymmetric access to resources and access to information. For example, the U.S., before it concluded negotiations around the Central America Free Trade Agreement, signed free trade agreements with Morocco and with Jordan. So very small economies, insignificant in the large scheme of things to the U.S.'s geopolitical objectives, but stepping stones along the way to carving out free trade zones around the world.
Sure.
So the U.S. Just concluded and just passed the Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. It sort of dragged itself across the finish line. It passed the House of Representatives by only two votes, or potentially one, depending on how you count it. And that only happened because the Bush administration and leadership in the House basically bullied Republicans and Democrats in the House into even switching their votes from the no column to the yes column. And votes were almost bought live on C-SPAN. It was quite a despicable hour-long vote that that you could see. And tucked into this so-called free trade deal is a chapter devoted to intellectual property rights that actually takes the floor that exists at the World Trade Organization level and builds upon it. So instead of treating this prioritization that countries agreed to of putting public health first during that ministerial meeting in Qatar in 2001, instead of stopping there, the Bush administration pushed these six Central American, well, five Central American and one Caribbean nations past that point and said, that's not enough. You've got to protect drug company patent rights more than even the WTO wants you to do. You need to set aside human rights and public health, because we have a larger commercial business plan that's more important than the lives of the 275,000 people in your region who are living with HIV. So unfortunately, these provisions are stuck in to this trade deal, and they're in many other trade deals that are currently under negotiation, and we're very concerned that it'll tie the hands of poor countries that are just now, mainly because of pressure from their own people and from international attention, these countries are just now starting to address their own AIDS pandemics. And if at the same moment that that's happening, their opportunity to use generic competition to broaden access to life-saving medicines is taken from their hands, well, that's taking a nightmare and making it far worse than it ever had to be.
And you are listening to the People's Power Hour on WIDR 89.1 Kalamazoo. And tonight we are speaking with Asia Russell. Asia Russell is Director of International Policy for HealthGap. Asia, could you tell us a bit about the campaign to end AIDS and what's going to happen when it comes through Michigan?
Sure. Campaign to End AIDS is a national effort to revitalize the AIDS activist movement in the United States by bringing people from across the country together in the spirit of the AIDS activist movement from the early 1990s and drawing attention to the fact that the tools exist in our midst to end the AIDS crisis. We know what works. Unfortunately, we've had more than two decades of experience grappling with this treatable, preventable infectious disease. We know people need access to comprehensive prevention tools. We know people need access to affordable health care and medicines, whether it's in the South Bronx or in Soweto or in Flint. And what we're missing is the kind of political will and focus from decision makers at local and national, international levels, and that's what we're helping to try to turn around through this effort, the campaign to end AIDS. So what's happening is there'll be caravans. It's very exciting, departing from points all around the country, traveling across states, bringing community members together through town hall meetings, through protests, through public events, and then converging the second week of October in Washington, D.C. for a week of prayer and action and education of members of Congress and demonstrations. So there's a caravan that's originating in Seattle that will be coming through several cities in Michigan in early October, and I want to invite people to find out more about that exciting event. People can go to the Campaign to End AIDS website. I could give that now.
Go ahead,
the URL
please.
Is www.endaidsnow.org. People can also call toll-free. The phone number is 1-877 and then the words End AIDS. So that's 1-877-363-2437. To find out more about what sort of local organizing is happening in Michigan and who they can get in touch with, which AIDS organizations, which support groups, which community organizations are getting involved in making this caravan really transform the interests of all different types of people who want to show their compassion and want to raise awareness. And the caravan is really all about transforming those efforts into political power and into achieving policy goals that will actually save people's lives.
Asia, one thing we often hear, I guess, from conservatives or defenders of the pharmaceutical corporations is that they've done the research and development for these products and they should be able to charge, whatever they want for them, whatever the quote-unquote market, will give them. But kind of aside from that, I've heard some people object and say that, in fact, these corporations receive a good deal of taxpayer subsidies to do this research and development, and I was wondering if there was any truth to that.
You actually have a really important point there. What we've found is this patent-based, monopoly-based system is actually very inefficient, whether you look at it as an activist or as an economist or as a healthcare provider. To take, again, the example of Pfizer, it's a drug company that invests about two times its profit into marketing as it does into research and development. So it's a screwy situation when you find drug companies are sort of battling for who has the best ad campaign rather than who has the best and most innovative research. And that's unfortunately the kind of broken product that a broken system like the one that we have gives us. I think another important point is that taxpayers actually get charged many times during the life cycle of a new innovative product before they actually get overcharged at the doctor's office. At the very earliest stage of a promising product's life, preclinical research or research before a drug actually enters a human body is actually heavily taxpayer-subsidized.
Is that through the National Institutes of Health?
Yeah, and there are lots of grants given out to researchers who collaborate with drug companies. And then when clinical trials actually happen in humans, again, the taxpayer is tapped for money. And then there are the tax breaks that happen that are meant to pull drug companies to the market. Of course, doesn't seem like there needs to be a lot of pulling in the first place, but that's the system that we have. So the drug companies often, cry and moan and say exposing how pricing links with access is actually a threat to sort of kill the goose that lays the golden egg. But that's not true. It would be more true if drug companies actually were forced to open the books so we had a better sense of what it really truly costs to bring a drug to market from beginning to end. And it would also be more true if we had a sense that any of the efforts that we were involved in would actually have any effect on their bottom line. I mean, we know that the CAFTA countries together represent less than 1% of the global pharmaceutical market. So we're talking about less than a rounding error for these major multinational pharmaceutical companies. So that argument's really a red herring, and I think we need a time of dialogue where we figure out what's a better system than what we have now that relies more on actually rewarding innovation rather than rewarding the marketing scheme that some, you know, ad executive can come up with in Pfizer or Merck's or Bristol-Myers Squibb's headquarters, and that really prioritizes, I mean, at the end of the day, do we really need another erectile dysfunction drug or another drug for male pattern baldness, or do we need a cure for sleeping sickness? We know the market's not going to solve that problem. It's political will from engaged people that'll address those problems. So those are the issues that we're actually grappling with.
Well, Asia, we want to thank you for appearing on the People's Power Hour. And if people want to learn more, what can they do?
They can visit our website by going to www.healthgap.org. That's www.healthgap.org. And again, to learn more about the campaign to end AIDS and what's going on in Michigan, go to www.endaids.org.
Again, thanks for appearing on the People's Power Hour.
Thanks so much.